Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. You join me on this great Tuesday night in February. What we've got tonight is some interesting discussion. We're going to be getting a phone call from Dr. Karen Ephraim, who is a pediatrician and the president of the Education Liberty Watch. I've heard Dr. Ephraim speak at several conferences, and I'm grateful to have her on our show, Homefront, where our mission is to find solutions to problems without involving government. So one thing I particularly like about Karen is she has got a vast network of people who totally understand how we're going to solve our problems. Karen, are you with us?
I am.
What a thrill.
Can you hear me?
Thank you. Yes, you sound like a doctor. Just what the doctor ordered. Thank you for being with us tonight. We have a number of really interesting questions coming up that I know that you are one of the few people in America who knows the answer. And I've read quite a bit about you and how you started off as a pediatrician. Can you explain to us why did you become a pediatrician?
I became a pediatrician after majoring in pharmacy in college, mostly because I wanted to give the orders instead of fill the orders. And then when I was in medical school, I realized that it was children that I really wanted to take care of the most. And I had a couple of really memorable patients during medical school that sort of sealed it for me.
And somewhere, originally, though, you wanted to be a pharmacist.
Well, that's what I started out with in at the beginning of college, because I loved chemistry and biology. And as I went through college, I realized that as good and important as pharmacists are, I wanted to be more directly involved in caring for patients.
Nice. So are you practicing now as a pediatrician?
No, I am not. I left several years ago to raise my children. I realized that after our second child was born, it was hard to be both a good mom and a pediatrician at the same time. And after I spent some time at home with my kids, I also realized that there were a lot of policy things happening. And actually, I ended up writing a paper for a think tank in Minnesota called the Center of the American Experiment, and that was seen in the policy, some policy network by Donna Hearn, and I came and did my very first speech at EPC in about 93 or 94, I think. And those two
policy
things kind of got me going in the policy realm.
Nice. So there was a day when your career shifted from a medical focus to an educational focus, which is very interesting because, you know, we like to believe that the disciplines are separated, that you're either in medicine or you're in education, and we're seeing the lines blur a little more. And can you tell us what is Education Liberty Watch?
Education Liberty Watch is a grassroots organization of mostly parents, some businessmen, some teachers, but just and grandparents and freedom-loving folks who think that it's vital that parents direct the education and nurture and medical care of their children.
Nice.
And not
because
wanting to have the government be in charge.
And that's what our show is about. How do we empower people to make the right decisions for themselves? Because with me, you know, we own a Christian bookstore and we sell homeschool materials. And a lot of the people who came in, they weren't just people who were motivated to try and go live in the backwoods and do it themselves. Many of them had already tried the public schools, and they'd given it their best shot. And they gave it everything they had, and they had failure on their hands. And then I had to remind them, remember this, the public school only has your child till he turns 18. You have him the rest of his life. So whether he turns out to be a success or a failure is what you're going to have to live with. They're going to go on and get a next new class next year with all new pupils and have their turn to see what they can make out of that. But your child is your child for life. And if they are successful, you live with that. And if they're failures, then that's, you know, what we all as parents are called to do everything we can to make our children successful.
Right.
So I found, you know, I'd like to talk about psychotropic drugs for a minute, because that's something that is really become pervasive. And I know that you also have quite a bit of information on ADHD, hyperactive disorder. We have got, in autism. There are more children today being diagnosed with autism and ADHD than ever in American history. And
right.
What do you think is causing all of this?
Well, part of it, it's a combination of factors. Part of it is that the criteria are developed by the American Psychiatric Association with their manual, their diagnostic and statistical manual, and actually with all of mental health, but especially with disorders or issues with children, the younger a child is, the harder it is to separate what is actual emotional or mental problem and what is just a hiccup in normal development. And that plus the criteria as admitted by the experts in the field are very subjective. So you have that part, you know, where the diagnostic criteria are squishy and there's no real it's all opinion, and there's no blood test or brain scan or anything that you can do. And then, on the other hand, you have many years of lots and lots of vaccines that contain neurotoxic substances like mercury and aluminum that we're giving to children starting at the day they're born. And probably having that environmental factor and a bunch of others. So, you know, on the one hand, it's probably overdiagnosis. On the other hand, it's probably environmental toxicity.
we've given them. And so we're at a point now. There was an article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday that said close to 9% of kids in Missouri have been diagnosed with ADHD, and about 80% of them take prescription drugs for this disorder. And only Mississippi has a higher rate of children with ADHD who are medicated. According to this, this is the Center for Disease Control that produced this. And the biggest surprise for me was it says fewer than 5% of children in Illinois have been diagnosed with ADHD, and that is under the national average, which is 7%. So here we are in Missouri. We border Illinois, and we're up to 9%. They're at 5%. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to understand why it would vary from state to state. On top of
Well, part of it is those diagnostic criteria, and also the screening that happens. You know, if kids are receiving these mental and emotional screening, either through preschool or through the pediatrician's offices, there's a greater likelihood that more kids will be caught in the dragnet.
Well, I'm sure. And also, there's a big difference between the way they handle it. Now, let me ask you about how you recommend, you know, since you're a pediatrician, what would you suggest to parents whose children are diagnosed with ADHD that they do? They get a choice between putting their children on pharmaceuticals or what?
Oh, I would run far and fast from pharmaceuticals. They are ineffective, and they are dangerous. And it is not worth what these drugs do. The University of Oregon in 2007 or so reviewed 2,800 different studies involving many thousands of children, and found that there was no long-term safety or efficacy of these medications.
Benefit. So we're putting our kids on, basically, it's speed, isn't it?
Right. It's a form of amphetamine. And these drugs, as stated by the FDA, and they actually had to tighten the warnings and you know, make clear that these drugs cause hallucinations, they cause violence, they cause weight loss, and they cause heart problems.
And parents are still left. A lot of them are getting pressured from the public schools, though. You either get them on something or else. And a lot of private schools are refusing to, they have the right of refusal. If they don't want to teach a child who's not medicated, they can say, can you please take your child somewhere else? Meanwhile, the public schools sometimes treat parents like they're lousy parents if they don't put them on something to make it easier for the teacher. What do you say about that?
Well, there are things that can be done to deal with this, but, you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. Everybody's, the size and shape of each piece for each child is different, but there's a whole number of factors that can be dealt with. One is good nutrition, removing artificial colors from the diet, making sure there's enough zinc and magnesium in the diet, either most likely through supplementation, because it's pretty hard to get as much as you need with the diet that most Americans consume.
Interesting.
Essential fatty acids can be very helpful. So that's one thing. Enough sleep. Putting controls on screen time, you know, computers and TVs and video games.
What do you think is going to happen with the advent of Obamacare? Do you think there will eventually be more pressure on everybody to get, if their child has a diagnosis, that they have to get on the drugs?
It's hard to say. I'm guessing that what they're doing to physicians is going to cause such a shortage that they're either going to have to allow psychologists and nurse practitioners and other people to prescribe these drugs, or else the number of diagnoses is going to decrease, because I don't think doctors are going to want to stay in practice. I think there's going to be a very severe and acute doctor shortage very shortly.
You wrote on your on Twitter this afternoon, you wrote, "Another one bites the dust. There will be two Americas, states with medical freedom and those without."
Yeah.
And that raises, you know, another issue, because we are going to see a change with Obamacare. We all know that. We haven't fully felt it, but where is it already being felt?
Well, insurance premiums are already going up. Many businesses are either laying people off or cutting the hours so that they are part-time employees, so that they do not have to pay, you know, so that they do not have to be counted as employees that need insuring. The Obamacare exchanges are starting to be developed in the states that are stupid enough to do them, like Minnesota. So those are some things.
Are you keeping track of how many states are falling for it?
I think there's 15 or 16 that are doing the exchange, and almost all of the rest of them, and almost all of them are governed by Republicans, are not doing the state exchange. And the state, if they don't do the state exchange, then they can just, if they're smart, not cooperate with the federal exchange. And if the federal exchange doesn't get any cooperation from the states, they get no data, then at least according to my friends that have really gone through the law in great detail, they cannot enforce the individual or the employer mandate for health insurance. In addition, if they aren't handing the feds the data, doctors can't be forced to submit to all these treatment protocols, and you won't have the death panels, you know, the independent payment advisory board and all, and PCORI, the patient-centered outcome research institute, which is basically, you know, the government deciding what diseases are going to be covered and how much coverage people will get for an individual condition.
That's really good, because we need to know, I mean, people can't imagine the future, but you can always look back and see history, and certainly there are many lessons to be learned from World War II and the way Germany conducted themselves, and how intrusive the government could become in, and things that we think would be completely intolerable. They believed that also in Germany, that they never would have believed that. And the government really kept a lot of the citizens from having any knowledge of what they were doing. It all kind of happened. And many Germans didn't find out until after the war was over how evil the government was. Many of the people who got put on the trains were not even aware. They were told they were being placed in a new area, and their hope and their imaginations allowed them to believe that the place where the train landed would put them in better conditions than where they were leaving from. Boy, weren't they surprised. And the problem with being surprised is it's so clear after you're there, the signs, you think, I should have known this. I could have seen it coming. I should have seen it coming. And now we not only have where we are in history today, but we have the benefit of looking back and seeing what else has happened within less than 100 years ago with the technology that they have. You add, multiply that with what we have today, and you've got a recipe for some very scary human experiments on all of us. And so I'm wondering if you can comment on why the government, why does the federal government want a database? You explained in the conference in January that when newborn babies are in the hospital, there's a heel prick and a drop of blood is being saved into a database. Can you explain a little more about who's required to pull that drop of blood, and do mom and dad have to give consent?
No, they do not in most states. There may be some. Well, and it varies. Actually, by the time we had our third child, I knew that we didn't have any major diseases, and so I refused the newborn screening. And they didn't give me a hassle about it because I'm a physician. But I imagine for families that were not in that situation, they probably would have gotten hassled. New York, I quoted a statement from the New York Department of Health that said that they can keep their citizens' blood spots without consent. So there may be a difference between, you know, parents consenting to the testing to begin with and knowing or not knowing whether they're those blood spots are kept.
When I was in the Missouri State Legislature, I actually was on the Health Care Policy Committee as the vice mm-hmm. chair, and we had hearings many times on people who wanted more mandates on newborn screenings. And there was one that was particularly dramatic when it seemed like 25 family members of a newborn baby came to the hearing. By now the baby was 9 months old and dying of a disease, and they said, if only you had mandated us, the state, to have a screening for this very rare and unusual disease, then we would have caught it early enough so that the baby would have lived. And with the Republicans in charge of both House and Senate, they pushed for that bill, and it passed easily through the Health Care Policy Committee and on the House floor because people felt like that's saving lives. And it really did sadden me because I knew it drove up the price of insurance for everybody. But more than that, it wasn't going to, once you mandate these screenings, you can't ever undo them. And it really should scare all of us. So what can they tell from that one drop of blood that goes into this database?
Well, there's a lot of reasonable things in there, you know, sickle cell anemia, thyroid disease, and certain rare metabolic diseases that can be fatal in very young infancy if they're not caught. However, they're starting to want to test for a lot of other things, and among them, although not yet, but among them may end up being mental health issues. And the problem with that, as I've already explained, is that mental health diagnoses are extraordinarily subjective, and there's never been a validated study showing a genetic cause to any mental illness. Yet, you know, there's already stigmatization of people that have and potential loss of employment or insurance if they have a physical genetic disease. Can you imagine what would happen if there's a, you know, if it gets to the point of doing genetic testing on mental diseases?
Well, it sounds like the guaranteed issue is going to, and that's what's really driven the cost so high already. It seems like the only reasonable answer is going to be to push more for a single payer, having government pay for everybody's medical insurance. Right now, it's on the individual and the employer to take care of the burden. The majority of the financial burden for health care is still paid by the individual. But when it gets to be too much, it seems like it will be the next step is, why don't we just have the government give everybody the same thing? Do you see that happening next?
Well, yes, I do. And everyone needs to remember that coverage is not the same as care. So even though people may be covered under Obamacare, they will quickly find out when everything is free, even now, that yes, they're not going to get care. And this, there are many, many, many examples of people who were covered who didn't get the care that they needed because of long waiting times and lists in countries that already have single-payer, Canada and France and England and all of these. But yes, that will be potentially an impetus to move to single payer, but I think it's going to be bad enough as it is.
Are you saying without single payer, Big Brother is still going to have access to our medical records?
It depends on what each state does. If the state sets up if the state already complies with the idea of electronic medical records, which was really pumped up in earnest by the stimulus bill in 2009. But if they continue with that and then join the exchange and hand the feds all of that data that's in the state, which is bad enough, then yes, that will keep going before single payer.
Why would the federal government be interested in all that data? I mean, isn't that going to translate into a lot of bookkeeping? And why are they that interested in each individual?
It's power and control. I mean, they can then decide who is worthy to be able to go to college or to get the plum job, or and as corporations and government become more aligned in education and workforce issues, that's going to be going on.
Trying to find out what is it? Are you talking about school to work?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So, what does what is Liberty Education, Education Liberty Watch, able to do to help people at this juncture?
Mostly, just being, as Michelle Bachman would say, being reporters at the front. We have promoted bills at a couple of bills at the federal level and many bills at the state level, mostly in Minnesota, although we have worked with activists in other states on specific issues. We got the Child Medication Safety Act passed twice in the House of Representatives with over 400 votes, but unfortunately it was killed in the Senate, and that would forbid schools that receive federal funds from coercing parents to put their children on psychiatric medication, at least the Ritalin type of medication.
It would stop them from, is that currently possible that a school can require a student to be on Ritalin?
Oh, yeah. And they can actually, and it has happened in the past that they would threaten the parents, not only with the kid not being able to go to school, but actually threaten the parents with a child abuse investigation.
Which means the state could remove the child from the home.
Right.
Which, I mean, really, when you talk about intervention, that should give us all shivers, because that's foundational to the right of parents to decide what they put in their child's body. And it's
right.
Bad enough that we've already seen an erosion of rights when it comes to parents. Let me talk, I'll just tell you about birth control, because When I was in the Missouri House of Representatives, I had actually filed a bill that says nobody can give prescription drugs to a minor without parental consent. And I thought that would be a no-brainer. And remember this, I was surrounded by Republicans who are free market and in favor of family and home, right? No.
Who also got many of their contributions from the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, you know, the idea, although it was originally aimed at, here's the point, if a minor is ingesting birth control pills, it's, number one, they may have complications that mom and dad should know about because mom and dad are financially responsible for the child.
Exactly.
And the idea, so originally I did design it, and secondly, if it's birth control, you need to have a talk with your child because if you don't, you're going to be a grandparent within a certain amount of time, most likely, and that's another complication that you may end up having to, it may cost you a lot of money. So the stakeholders have a right to know, and that was amazing to me that I went around in circles with the lawyers in the bill drafting department who were convinced that it would be unconstitutional to require mom and dad to know if their daughter is taking birth control pills because of this somehow this, when it comes to anything related to reproduction, there's no such thing as a girl, they're all women. And that I found very offensive and very erosive of parental rights. We have to stand strong and stand up and say, that's my child, I have a right to know. And I broadened the bill to be any drug because that makes sense that if it's a prescription drug, that automatically means that you're not supposed to be taking this without a physician authorizing such. And yet, you know, probably there's a black market for Ritalin and other amphetamines that many times children do get prescribed these and then they go to school and sell them, which has now necessitated school policies that say, but you're not supposed to sell this, at least not on school property now. So we've really messed it up even worse, and I don't know what the answer is, but I can tell you this much, sitting back is not going to solve it. It's only making things worse. We are not getting better as a society. The pharmaceuticals are not making us more honorable people that now have better control over our lives. So what are your suggestions for how to rectify this?
Well, first of all, two-parent families.
Oh, I love that.
There's oodles and buckets of data that show that children with two-parent families have far fewer academic or emotional problems. They don't tend to commit suicide. They don't tend to be involved with drugs or, you know, sex or pregnancy. It's just overwhelming the number, you know, the power of two-parent families to inoculate their children from many of life's ills. So that's one.
Two parents are going to hold them accountable, too, to a greater degree.
Right.
If one
right.
is aloof, you've got a second chance that somebody else will be paying attention.
Well, absolutely. Plus, psychological studies and essays, you know, it just shows that kids are wired to need both parents. They just are. And, you know, that's why the crime rate and the drug use rate and the emotional problems and suicide are so high in kids with only one parent. So that's really important. And for any health and education policy, it's just really important to start there.
Yeah, that's good. Can you talk to us about Race to the Top? A lot of my listeners may not be as familiar with it because you alluded to that and some of the provisions of how that, has had a detrimental effect on where we're headed. We all know pretty much what No Child Left Behind was. It was a package of reforms that they meant to make sure that children would be better off at the end. And that was, again, pushed by a Republican president with a Republican Congress. Now we have a Democrat president and a Democrat Senate and Republican House that's very weak and spineless, it seems. They're not willing to stand up and be brave and strong. But how is Race to the Top going to affect the way we see education conducted? And is it the same thing as No Child Left Behind? Okay, Karen. Whoopsies. Okay, Karen. Karen, I'm sorry. Are you there?
I am here now. My line just went dead.
I apologize.
Talking.
Tell me about, go ahead and talk with us about the Race to the Top and how that's different from No Child Left Behind.
Well, you want to talk about Race to the Top? K-12 or Race to the Top early learning?
Well, most people don't know what it even is. So give us a kindergarten level understanding of what we're looking at and how it's going to interfere with the way we run our lives.
Okay. Race to the Top and the Common Core Standards are basically Obamacare for education. No Child Left Behind was bad enough, but what Race to the Top did was require several things for states to get grant money, and most states in 2009 were so desperate for cash because of the terrible economy and big budget deficits that they were willing to dance to the Piper's tune, and the Piper is the federal government. And they required standards for either early childhood or K-12. They required a longitudinal database for both. They required a big emphasis, actually both of them, on early childhood. And the early childhood Race to the Top required something called a quality rating system. And the standards that both of these grant programs required, although giving the image to the public that it was state-run and voluntarily developed and voluntarily taken, it was basically either bribery or blackmail, depending on which way you wanted to look at it, because the states were so desperate for the money that they were willing to do just about anything. And No Child Left Behind, as bad as it was, hadn't been renewed or reauthorized for several years. And instead of going through the messy fight in Congress to reauthorize it, they just developed this grant program without a single word of congressional hearing, and just stuck it into the stimulus bill. And every state, almost every state, tried for a grant and made big changes in their education policy, even though only, I think, 11 or 12 states ended up getting the money. And in the Common Core standards for K-12 in math and reading were adopted by 45 or 46 states, many of whom adopted them or agreed to adopt them before they were even finished. And there were all sorts of problems with the K-12 standards as far as rigor and quality and transparency and trying to find out, you know, who was actually on the writing committee. And it was just a mess, but they went through. And then they also, the states also had to promise not only to change their standards according to these standards, they had to be adopted verbatim, and they had to promise to give assessments based on these national standards. So we went from state-developed standards and assessments under No Child Left Behind with the federal government you know, forcing that, which was bad enough, to national standards and basically national assessments.
Which is really insulting to the states, because it's based on an assumption that we aren't smart enough to know how to educate our children without the state having to tell us how to do it. And when it was happening in Missouri, I remember saying, is there nobody smart enough in Missouri to help tell us how we should best educate our children, that we need to look to Washington, D.C. to tell us how to educate them? It really is patently offensive when you think about the broad picture of what we're doing to ourselves, what we're giving up, our rights to educate them the way we want them educated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like, you know, Washington has it figured out, and we're such doofuses here, we don't even know what to do with a child. So it definitely was a money grab. And I think what you're saying is it's like everybody was taking a whack at the pinata, but only 12 out of 50 were going to get the candy.
Right, right.
At the time.
But to get the chance to, you know, to even take the whack, they had to, they really had to do a lot. And, you know, it's totally away from the idea of the Constitutional Republic that our framers and founders envisioned.
And the way Obamacare works, the state legislatures have to vote to set up the exchanges, but the way our education policy is structured, we've pretty much turned that over to our Board of Education. And
right.
So if the state board, you know, I as a legislator didn't have anything to do with Race to the Top. Now, there are legislators who could speak about what a great program it was, and they did so because they were educrats, but
they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't even finished.
Well, they could support it or promote it in the public, but they had no vote on it. Completely circumvented the state legislature in our state. It was up to, however, the Department of Education, the state board, wanted to deal with it. Here we are today looking at our country and asking, how has it fallen so far? How did the water get muddied between medical and education? That amazes me, too, because we thought we wanted the teachers to teach, not be moms and dads. So I remember while I was in the legislature even, a bill was passed, which I voted against, but it mandated all the public schools have to send home a form that parents have to fill out and turn back in saying the answer to the question, do you have medical insurance or not? And that's really not an issue that our local state or our local school district should deal with. That's not an academic question. And yet, I called the Department of Health and asked, whatever are you going to use this information for? And they told me they will go out and recruit families for the Medicaid program if they answer that they don't have medical insurance. Well, you know, that is not an educational event. That's a medical event, but how did the line get so blurred that, you know, nobody knows what their jobs are anymore? I think the answer is that it became one of Big Brother needed to grow big. If the government's goal is to become bigger and more intrusive and more invasive and more expensive, then there's a point where it's just more of the same, and they will try to continue encroaching on the line until we say, stop, that's enough.
We have to stop. We have to stop because they want to start doing mental health screening in infancy. They want to have a hold of our genetic data. They want to, in response to the Sandy Hook shooting, the Minnesota legislature in all its wisdom has just introduced a bill to have mental health education as part of the curriculum in the schools. Yeah, it just goes on and on and on. And another bill where teachers have to look for signs of mental illness in their kids, in their students.
What is mental health education that they would present? You're saying they would teach that to the students just like they teach sex education?
Mm-hmm. Yep. According to the National Physical Education and Health Standards, they have to add mental health to the curriculum.
And when I was in the Republican-held legislature in Missouri is when they created mental health parity. And, again, you expect that the Democrats would want to do that, but you don't expect the Republicans to want to do that. And once they did that, that had an adverse effect on insurance premiums as well, because it used to be that we paid for things that had to be empirically diagnosed with real data, blood pressure or something, you know, a test, a urine test, a saliva test, a blood test, something that you can look at under a microscope and say, yep, that's a disease. And when you get into mental health, you're now forcing everybody to cover different conditions that are very subjective, that we really aren't sure it's just whatever you say it is. And then you've got people who may claim to be in pain, and I'm speaking about people who I know, and then they get the painkillers, which then they can use because it's less expensive than buying alcohol or marijuana. And
oh, yeah.
Now we've got a situation in America where we've got prescription drugs are causing, once again, going full circle in this broadcast, you have the addiction to prescription drugs is every bit as bad as being addicted to alcohol or illegal drugs. So what is
yep.
the solution? If you were going to give my listeners your advice on what can we do to make a difference, what would you tell us that we need to do to change the course we're on in this country?
Well, strengthen families, teach your own children to the extent possible. I mean, I realize not everybody can homeschool, but, you know, homeschool or private school is getting, you know, it's getting to the point where it's becoming more and more necessary, I think. Elect politicians that have an understanding of economics and fidelity to the Constitution. Limit your children's screen time. I mean just time in front of TVs and computers.
Okay.
And there's a whole list of policy things that I think should be done, but it's going to be very hard to do them, especially right now after Sandy Hook.
Does the time in front of the TV or computer change their brains, or is it just a waste of time? You don't have to be productive.
Some of each, and then there's also the issue of electrical fields. You know, the actual radiation from these devices isn't very good for growing and developing kids.
For goodness sake, you never hear them talk about that.
No.
Wow, not from your pediatrician, at least. Wow.
No. But actually, the World Health Organization has found that kids that there's a number of intellectual and emotional problems with cell phones and too much exposure to electronic equipment.
Well, I'm glad you had a chance to add that little nugget to the end of this show. You have been an incredible blessing. I appreciate your wisdom, your knowledge, your expertise, and just being a beacon. The world's not getting better on its own. And going to live in a cave isn't really an option. So
no.
if you don't want to live in a cave, I just want to say thank you. I appreciate your time explaining this to us, and God bless you. Thanks for being on our show, Karen.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And if your listeners are interested edlibertywatch.org or edwatch.org.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.
Karen, I didn't...